Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Welcome back to All of It. I'm Allison Stewart. In 2020, we saw how Black Lives Matter inspired a new generation of youth activists to push for social, racial, and economic justice across the country. The energy of young Americans who want a better future has fueled civil rights for decades. So today, as we celebrate the legacy of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., we thought we would revisit our conversation with the youngest person to participate in the 1965 Selma Voting Rights March, Linda Blackman Lowry. Lowry marched the 54 miles from Selma to Montgomery with thousands of protesters, including MLK Jr., to secure the rights of African Americans to vote. She was only 15 at the time. In fact, when she started the march, she was just 14. Her birthday fell in between the two cities. But even at 14, she'd already been jailed 9 times for her activism in Selma. Linda recorded her story in a 2015 memoir, Turning 15 on the Road to Freedom, My Story of the 1965 Selma Voting Rights March. Her story was adapted into a stage play. Linda Blackman Lowry joined us on MLK Day in 2019, and we love this interview. I think we might just play it every MLK Day going forward. A heads up, listeners, though, this interview does contain a racial slur. During the interview, Linda talks about being called the N-word twice during the protests on Bloody Sunday, and as it is her story and her life experience, we are not deleting her words. I began by asking Linda about the first chapter in her book titled Growing Up Strong and Determined. She was born in Selma in 1950. I asked her to describe what Selma was like during her early childhood.
We lived in the GWC homes, and we were very well protected, I say, against the outside forces. When our parents would take us downtown, uptown, as we say it, uptown, you know, we then knew that we couldn't go in certain stores, and we learned that we couldn't try on clothes or shoes or other things, couldn't eat at, you know, get ice cream from certain counters and so forth. So it was, but that was okay with us little kids because we didn't know any better. The thing that, my mother died when I was 7 years old. That was September the 19th, 1957. And my grandmother and the older people said she wouldn't have died if she hadn't been colored, meaning there was this all-white hospital that had the blood she needed, but she could not get it. Now, this is when I really realized that white people hated black people, and black people were supposed to hate them back. But I didn't think the white people would hate us so much they'd let our mother die. Or my dad and his wife die. My grandmother's only child died. But that's, to me, that's what happened. So I decided at 7 years old, I made a vow that when I got big, I was going to change things. Nobody else would, mother would die because of the color of her skin. I also tell people that at 7 years old, I hated white people with every little being of my seven-year-old body. I sat on, straddled that fence, that racist fence. I hated, and I was being hated. I knew that. I am so happy that there was a movement that showed me a different type of white person than the ones I grew up with.
It's interesting you describe the community, because I remember my parents grew up in segregated Washington, and my mom specifically, and she and her friends initially described it as a cocoon, because you lived with people who cared about you and cared about your education and cared about your rights and your life. But the minute you left, you were confronted with the rest of the world.
Yes.
And that could be an incredibly harsh reality. And it sounds like that was something that you experienced in your youth.
The GWC homes was like that proverbial African village. Everyone did help and take care of each other, because everybody had basically the same. And like I say in my book, if someone couldn't pay their rent, they had card parties and fish fries and chicken dinners and whatever to raise that money to give to that person. Nobody talked about, oh, we paid Allison's rent, you know, because the next month,
could be you.
it could be you. The next week, your child would need some medical care or medicine or something that people had to raise money for.
When did you become aware of MLK?
I first became aware of him in 1963. That's when my grandmother told us we were going to see King and dressed us up in our Sunday clothes. And at the time, there was a story on television every Saturday morning called Sergeant Preston of the Yukon. And he had this magnificent German Shepherd named King. So we knew we was going to see the German Shepherd. And we were all excited. We had decided how we were going to shake his paw and who we was going to let King save and everything. It was about, it looked like 700 people in the church. And we had told all the kids knew we were going to see the German Shepherd. And we looked for him, and we looked for him, and all of a sudden, this man named Mr. James Baldwin got up and introduced Reverend Martin Luther King, Jr. And we were some disappointed children.
Where's King the dog?
Where is our King? You know, but when Reverend King started to speak, everybody got quiet and still and was looking up at him with wonder and awe. And I know I was, and trying to hear every word he said. A lot of things I didn't understand. But he was talking about our parents having the right to vote. And getting that right to vote through nonviolence. He said that you can get anybody to do anything with steady, loving confrontation. And I heard it when he said it the first time. But the second time he said it in that speech, he said, Linda, you can get anybody to do anything with steady, loving confrontation. And I remember jumping up saying, oh, yeah, that's how I'm going to do it. And my grandmother pulling me back down on the pew saying, shut up, child.
Behave.
Church. But it was an awesome speech he gave me at 13. He gave me the power or the energy I needed to keep my vow that I made at 7.
Hmm. Folks, I am talking with Linda Blackman Lowry about her own experience as the youngest marcher on the Selma Voting Rights March. I really was interested in your book because you write a lot about how important kids were in the civil rights movement and how they were used, I don't mean in a bad way, but they were used very effectively to help out. Will you share with people how you and your friends were part of the civil rights movement to the point where you got tossed in jail 9 times before 15?
Well, we knew during the year between 63 and 65, we were trained in nonviolence. But the children of Selma also knew that their parents couldn't go and march. If they went to jail, then their children would be taken from them, less known the job, but their children would. So we were the ones that knew we needed to do this. We organized ourselves with the help of some young people from SCLC and SNCC. We had it all planned and arranged. Whenever they said we were going to go march, we knew that some children would be staying in school. We knew and we got them on board because they had to do our homework and lessons for us. If we weren't in jail, we would go to school that morning, say present for whatever federal dollars the school got, you know. And then we'd let our teachers know what march we wanted to go on. Our teachers were some of the smartest and caringest people you'd ever want to meet, but they couldn't vote, couldn't pass the voter registration test.
Mm-hmm.
And so we organized. The Selma movement was a children's movement, and the 1965 Voting Rights Act passed by Congress on August 6th of that year was because of children.
I'm going to ask you to read this passage about being taken to a place called Camp Selma. So if you'd read that through there so our listeners can get a little taste of your book, Turning 15 on the Road to Freedom.
Okay. Once, when the city jail was full, the police took 3 busloads of us kids to a prison camp called Camp Selma. This prison was about 5 miles away from town. After about 3 days there, they took us to another prison camp even farther away. It was late at night and we couldn't see anything. So at first we thought they must be taking us back to Selma, but pretty soon we knew we'd been riding too long to be going home. I was scared, and I think everyone on all 3 buses were scared. We were sure our parents did not know where we were, and they didn't know that we had been put in a state prison camp. We were gone for 6 days. Finally, when our leaders in Selma found out where we were, they demanded our release. The buses brought us back to Selma, and we all ran home as fast as we could. We needed baths and something to eat besides black eyed peas. That was the longest time I was ever in jail.
That's Linda Blackman Lowry. She is my guest today on MLK Day. The name of her book is Turning 15 on the Road to Freedom, My Story of the 1965 Selma Voting Rights March. And I hope you don't mind. I think you don't. I'd love to talk to you about Bloody Sunday,
okay.
About that day. And what do you remember the most from that day?
Besides getting beat, yeah. I remember that it was a solemn march leaving the playground next to Brown Chapel Church. And that was unusual for us because songs and the music kept the spirit up. But we were marching two abreast, got to the apex of the bridge, and all we could see was Alabama state troopers standing across this double highway. I mean, it was a lot of them. And the sheriff, Jim Clark, and his posse. And then he had the posse on horseback, too. When John and Hosea got down to the front, and the state trooper told him that we were an illegal assembly, there would be no march from Selma to Montgomery that day. We had 3 minutes to disperse and go back to our homes or church. Mm-hmm. Normally, when we were stopped and they weren't taking us to jail, we would kneel, pray, get up, and go back and regroup. And my team leader, James Webb, said to kneel. So everybody, I was in the 19th row from the front. Everybody from the 18th row back was kneeling.
Mm-hmm.
And then all of a sudden there was these sounds like gunshots, and there was this smoke coming up from the ground. It burned your eyes, your nose. You couldn't breathe. You couldn't see. Very confusing. And I felt somebody pulling me backwards by the back of my collar, and I was resisting. So this person decided to put both hands on the front of my coat and jerked me back. So as he jerked me back, one of his hand came up by my mouth, and I bit him.
Oh, you were so scared. I mean, you have to think about this scene for people. You had 600 marchers. You had the law enforcement, which was openly cruel. Antagonistic and cruel and on horseback with tear gas. Mm. And there you are, 15-year-old. I don't blame you for biting somebody if they were trying to help you. Were you afraid in the moment?
I was scared, yes, because we had never been attacked with such violent force. And after I bit this person, there's no politically correct way for me to say the N-word. The word is nigger. That's what I was called.
Mm-hmm.
He called me a nigger twice and hit me in my forehead. Then he pushed me away, and I guess I was able to roll over, get up, and I ran straight into this cloud of tear gas, and this man was running behind me, hitting me. I fainted, passed out, because when I woke up, I was on this stretcher. Mm. And they were putting me in the back of a hearse. And I let them know I was not dead and I wasn't going in that hearse. So I started running back across the bridge. When I got back on the Selma side, I saw my 11-year-old sister, Joanne.
Oh, you must have been so happy to see her.
And no, she was in this man's arms, and she was looking like a rag doll, and she looked like she was dead to me. And all I could do was stand there in shock. I couldn't move because I knew that I had Joanne out there marching, and I should have been protecting her.
She fainted, though. You found out that she had fainted.
Yes.
There's a really beautiful illustration in the book. Yeah. That, you know, in our final few minutes, what do you hope people remember on today, on this day? You have such a strong memory. What do you hope people remember?
Remember that Dr. King fought for justice for all. He fought for unity. He fought for the equal rights for all. Just remember what a strong person he was and how he brought a nation together. And remember that you have a voice, and you need to use that voice to not only today, but every day when you see injustices. Because if you or I don't lift our sister, brother, or community up, all of us will fall down. And that won't be a good thing.
That was my conversation with Linda Blackman Lowry about her book, Turning 15 on the Road to Freedom, My Story of the 1965 Selma Voting Rights March.